Support for the Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. It's the Capital Connection. Hi, I'm David Gustino. With us this week, a special guest, Judy Patrick. She is the vice president of the New York Press Association. Judy, of course, well known to WAMC listeners for her role as a panelist on the Roundtable and the Media Project. She's the former editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady, one of the last independently owned local papers, and she joins us on the Capital Connection this week. Welcome, Judy.
Thank you for having me. I am delighted to talk to you about local news.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you're here because in order to know about, for example, New York State government and politics, we need the press. We need journalism of verification, the reporting that's necessary so that New Yorkers can better understand what their legislators are doing, what the associations and the lobbyists are doing. And to that end, your organization represents and looks after the local papers across New York State. Give folks a sense of the history of the New York Press Association. It goes back a long way.
Right. It goes back into the 1800s when we first started representing all the local newspapers in New York State, advocating for them both at the state level and the national level. I have read stories about publishers from New York State taking trains to Washington to meet with the president. So we have a long history of being involved with our local papers. Remember that since the founding of our country, newspapers have played an essential role in getting people informed about what their country is doing, what their elected officials are doing, what's happening in their communities, and it's become a vital role. It's always been a vital role in our democracy, and one of my jobs now is to help keep that vital role alive and to help those local newspapers thrive.
Oh, and that's not something that's very easy these days. We see one newspaper after another, and that doesn't also eliminate places like public radio or radio news or even TV, which are all suffering layoffs largely around the country and even in our region. But that shows you that the model for journalism is struggling. Now with online and internet, it's harder and harder for newspapers specifically to get those advertising dollars. So, Judy, you focus on those local papers. Give us a sense of how many there have been and where we are now in terms of the number of local papers across New York.
Our organization represents more than 500 local newspapers, which comes as a surprise to many people that they don't know that there are so many daily and weekly newspapers out there. That doesn't include the, you know, the free advertisers. Those are newspapers that produce local content. To be sure, in the last 10, 20 years, the business model has changed dramatically, in large part because our business climate has changed. The internet has taken away much of our local advertising dollars, but also all those small downtown businesses have shuttered because of the rise of internet commerce. So what we've been trying to do is come up with new ways of balancing the balance sheet to have revenues and expenditures equal out so we can run what essentially are small businesses effectively. But it's a challenge, and there's no doubt that there are fewer reporters out there than there were 20 years ago, that every newsroom is smaller. But I have to tell you that throughout New York State, from Plattsburgh to Buffalo to the tip of Long Island, there are small newspapers out there with reporters going to town hall meetings, zoning board meetings, planning meetings, covering festivals. It's still happening. What they need is the local support. And one of my challenges and one of my roles is to help all of those editors and reporters and publishers come up with ways to better serve their community so their community will respond, both in part by advertising or contributing or becoming members, and also to help the local commerce as well. It's an ever-going challenge, but I actually see the corner turning. I think that people are becoming more aware about how important local news is to a civil society of people talking back and forth to each other, of local government working well. I mean, Everything is local. We talk a lot about national news, but everything national starts at the local level, and we can't forget that. And the local news, whether it be the local radio station, the newspaper, or local TV station, that's where it all starts.
Yeah, and you can't water that down. You need that local identity, don't you? And isn't it that criteria for what makes news proximity, that information that's closest to me, those events, those people, those ideas that are closest to me is something I'm going to want to receive. So one of the things you've told us on the Media Project is that people still want their local news.
Oh, they do. And in study after study at the national level, we talk about the lack of trust in news. And it's true that there has been social media and, you know, the input of influential politicians has degraded some people's trust in news. But when it comes to local news, that's the news they trust because in many respects, the people in the community know the local reporters, or over time they've gotten to know Dave Gustina. And when he says something, they trust it. So it's become more and more of a valuable part of the community. I mean, you can read something on Facebook or Instagram or TikTok, but if you don't trust the source, if it's not a credible source, are you sure that, you know, there was a fatal car accident on this road? You really don't know for sure unless you read it or hear about it on an organization that has some legacy, has some credibility, and that's what I'm trying to build up so much.
Yeah, that trust is so very important. It's what we rest on in journalism of verification, which is what you're talking about. Reporters going out and speaking to the sources and getting the information directly. And that is not the same as these, for example, we're seeing now, and I heard it on our air, the social media influencers now that are getting press credentials, basically, essentially, for example, at the Democratic National Convention. What do you make of that?
Yeah, that's a kind of a scary trend, but I understand the need of, you know, politicians to meet the audience where they are. We talk a lot about that on the Media Project, too, that we can't just put words on a page. We have to blog. We have to podcast. We have to do photo stories. That's our challenge. But the idea that you have to have someone who has some background or experience or wisdom when it comes to what you disseminate and what you don't. One of the things that newspapers do so well is they edit. We don't just, you know, disgorge all the information we have. We decide what's important and what's not. And some people will say, well, who are you to decide what's important
exactly
from a press conference and what's not? Well, it's experience that shows us. It's skill. It's training. Otherwise, you are going to be swamped with needless information that's going to bore you, and you're going to walk away. Our job is to make it interesting, to tell you the high points, and to put it into some context and perspective. We're trained to do it years and years. Many professionals are new. It's true, but many of them have, you know, decades of experience, and that's not to be overlooked.
Absolutely not. Let's talk about that for a second. We're talking about historical memory. You know, the trend in a lot of places, especially broadcast journalism, is to let the old folks go and bring in the new kids. But the new kids don't have that historical memory. They don't know the history, for example, of the region, and can't necessarily put a lot of events in context that way. And we're seeing that loss. I'll give you one example. Here in our capital of New York, in Albany, we no longer have our Capitol Bureau Chief, Karen DeWitt, years and years and years on the job, who understood the legislature and its machinations. That's gone now, and we lose something when that happens, don't we?
So many things. You lose context. You lose why something's important, or you lose the ability to identify something that's happening as a story. Some things are stories because of what happened before, and if you don't know what happened before, you can't put it in context. And the other thing is there's a whole audience of people who are older and remember the history, and when you come out with a story that shows that you don't know the history, you're showing your ignorance and you're losing your credibility. One of the challenges my newspapers are facing, for example, is a lack of their archives. You know, there are these great big books that are in their libraries, and they're harder to search, and so it's not as easy to go back and find out the obituary for somebody important or the life history of somebody. So we're relying on people's heads, their memories, and when you lose a veteran, you lose so much more than just their skill and their wisdom. You lose their walking memory. And I'm sure government coverage at WAMC and in public stations across New York State will be okay, but we don't know the stories we'll miss because Karen's gone.
Yeah. And as a result of a lot of what we've been talking about with the press and some of it fading to a certain extent, New York has just committed $90 million to help save local journalism. The question is, will it work? You know, the first state, it's called the Journalism Sustainability Act. It was included in New York's budget this year, and it set aside $90 million to subsidize local news for the next 3 years. Eligible outlets can apply to receive a refundable tax credit of up to $25,000 for the first $50,000 worth of employees' salaries, and with a per-company cap of $300,000. Will this be helpful?
Well, it certainly will be helpful. We're still waiting to see exactly how it will work. I think the Empire State Development Corporation is the one who is coming up with the exact rules about how it will work. They talk about Sustainability Act. So whether or not this will put more reporters on the street is up to each individual paper or news organization. How the money will be distributed hasn't been determined at this point. Who's qualified? You know, are small local radio stations, are bloggers qualified? I think those are the kinds of things that need to be resolved at this point. And also, the news organization can use the money, not necessarily for reporters, they can, or they could use it for a new software system or, you know, to bolster their sales staff, to innovate in different ways. So it's up to the papers. What I think is important for us to do is to track this, to see how the money is spent, who gets it, and do what we do all the time, is to hold ourselves accountable to make sure the money is spent and truly helps local journalism. It's only a 3-year program, remember. And so what do we do at the end of the 3 years is another issue. So it can't hurt, but I think our challenge now is to watch and see what happens and to see that the money's well spent.
We're speaking with Judy Patrick, the vice president of the New York Press Association. You can find out more at newyorkpressassociation.com. Judy is also the former editor of the Daily Gazette. And for those of you on WAMC, you know her from the Roundtable and the Media Project, where we talk about these specific issues, including this one. But I'd like your response for our Capital Connection listeners, Judy. The New York Times announcing no more political endorsements. Now, this is strange to me. I know many don't like this idea, although many of us might agree that endorsements, how much impact they have, I don't really know. And does it really matter? What do you think?
Well, whether or not it matters, I think, may be beside the point. As you recall, most newspapers in the country did not endorse Donald Trump in his run for presidency, and it didn't seem to make a difference. But it does make a difference in terms of the media's responsibility to be engaged. And the New York Times deciding not to endorse at the state and mayoral levels in their realm, that seems like an abrogation of the responsibility. Maybe they don't need to endorse in every city council race or the assembly and senate races, but they have an important role to play in the community, and it seems like they're stepping away from it. A lot of local newspapers still endorse candidates, and it's a lot of work, I'll concede. My newspaper that I worked at 40 years or so, most of the years I worked there, we did not endorse. We believed, the publisher at that time believed, that we should leave it to the voters to decide, or the citizens to decide who they should vote for. Who were we to tell them? But over time, I've realized that people who cover the news, who read the news, whose job it is to stay on top of the news, they come to these decisions with a heightened level of wisdom, again, and experience. And I do treasure their opinions. And so I'm sad to see New York Times step away from this, and I hope they reconsider, at the very minimum, at the state and at the mayoral level.
Well, let's talk about something that's very frustrating for journalists. And that's when we want to get information from public officials and we file a FOIL request. This is the Freedom of Information Law.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just one of these things where the law really has no teeth, does it?
Oh, if I'm talking to editors across the state, this is their biggest frustration. And as you remember, when Kathy Hochul took over as governor, she promised transparency in New York State, that she was going to have all of her agencies file transparency reports and to reply to FOILs as quickly as possible. That hasn't happened. State government remains very inaccessible when it comes to securing information, and local governments as well. Paper after paper, they file FOILs, Freedom of Information requests, and they wait and wait and wait. And by the time the FOIL is received, the request for information, it could be what's happening with this contract or what's happening with a budget. By the time they get the information, it's too late to run the story. The issue's dead. There are a package of bills before the legislature every year, it seems, to fortify the Freedom of Information request, to require tougher deadlines, and to install some penalties if local governments and state governments do not comply with the Freedom of Information request on time or in a timely manner. I mean, papers are waiting months, sometimes even years. I've had situations where the reporter has gone and left to another paper by the time the Freedom of Information request has been returned. You know, the city of Niagara Falls, for example, has been trying for months to get some information from the city of Niagara Falls about how much money they've spent on eminent domain acquisition of land for this new Centennial Park that they're building, and they haven't gotten the information. There's story after story across the state. The challenge for the local papers is trying to get this information. Their only recourse is to go to court. To go to court, they need to hire a lawyer, and hiring a lawyer in many cases means that they're going to have to take money out of their newsroom budget, which means fewer people on the street asking questions, and they can't make those kind of decisions.
And Judy, the politicians know it.
They know it. They're calling our bluff. They're saying, we know you're not going to be able to go to court, so we're just not going to file it. Now, there are some resources available, like Cornell Law School. They have a First Amendment Center, and they have resources for papers, especially in the metro area and on Long Island, that will help them file those, what we call Article 78s in Supreme Court, to challenge the denials of Freedom of Information requests. But that shouldn't be the case. The law should make it easier for us to get the information to which we are entitled. New York State and every local government should have the attitude that the information should be given to the people. Instead, they tend to have the attitude that this is our information and we'll give it to you if we want to. That's the wrong way to do it. Democracy works best, as I say again and again, when the people have the information. They're entitled to the information. We shouldn't have to work so hard for it. And state government needs to do a far better job of helping us get that information, especially when our newsrooms are dwindling, that we have fewer people to chase these FOILs, these Freedom of Information requests. We just don't have the resources. Why has government made it so hard? When the law was first enacted in the late 70s, things were so much easier because there was a respect for our rights to know. And it seems like over those years, that has degraded, and it's far harder to get that information now than it was all those years ago. And it's so frustrating for young reporters because they go in and they say, oh, I'll just file a Freedom of Information request and I'll find out how much pollution is going into the river or how much the new superintendent is being paid in their contract. And they think it's going to be simple. And when they realize how hard it is, it's devastating and it's tough on the morale. And editors and senior reporters across the state have to explain to these young, idealistic reporters that it's not as easy as you might think.
We're speaking with Judy Patrick. She's the vice president of the New York Press Association, and you're listening to The Capital Connection. I'm David Gustino. Well, I guess it comes down to this, Judy. Our profession is part of the Bill of Rights. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people to peacefully assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. There it is. Enshrined. And that's why you say, you know what, we're entitled to this information. And I want to switch it over from FOIL to just public officials in general and the press. They have inserted themselves into the public arena. They decided to run for office. They're putting themselves out there. They are now public officials. We have a representative democracy. Therefore, aren't they obligated to speak with the media, especially public and nonprofit media?
Hey, we've had this discussion recently about the fact that Vice President Kamala Harris, who's the Democratic designee for president at this point, hasn't, at least at the recording of this show, given an interview with the press. Now, people will argue, well, she can take her case directly to the people through all these different ways of social media. Sure, she can, but that's a one-way conversation. She's not taking questions. She may take a question here and there as she's getting off and on a plane, or she may take a question from the crowd, but she's not taking what we call hardball questions from real reporters who know the real issues. Now, that may be a fine campaign tactic for her, because once you go out there and you state your positions and you answer those questions, you're more subject to attack. But you're also giving the public the information they need. And that's how it works. We're not You know, it's the First Amendment for a reason. It's number one. It's, you know, we're in the First Amendment, and it's not like we're, certainly we're a business, but we're a business with an important civic responsibility. And it, we're not asking the questions just for ourselves, and we're not asking the questions to sell newspapers or to get clicks. We're asking the questions on behalf of our readers, of our listeners. We're standing in for them because they can't all be there. And I think that is overlooked in this day and age when politicians just bypass us or use us as tools to get the message they want across. If you just listen to campaign press releases, you're not going to be well informed.
I agree, Judy. And the truth is, more than one thing can coexist. You can still sell newspapers, but be seeking the truth and trying to get the information out there.
Right. You sell newspapers, you grow your audiences by giving the people information that they care about, they need to know. It's an important civic role, and I think sometimes it's overlooked. You think that Facebook is going to be your social, you know, your community. Well, spend enough time on Facebook and you realize it's a very unsatisfying relationship.
Yeah. Well, one of the things we need to think about with any presidential administration is what will be the impact on the press? Now, we have seen, for example, former President Donald Trump, current Republican candidate, denigrating the press, fake news and get these people out of here. And you're one of those. We saw him at the National Association of Black Journalists and what he did there. And, you know, the issue of libel and changing the libel laws, I believe he's made reference to that as well.
Oh, right. It's a very serious issue. What will happen to longstanding protections the press has had in terms of libel, for example, that if those libel laws are loosened up, if it's easier to sue us for libel, then our jobs are going to become so much more difficult. It's not like the libel laws are loose now. I mean, in large part, every credible news organization takes great pains not to make mistakes. But when you are producing, you know, 1,000 facts a day, and in a local newspaper, in a daily radio broadcast, there are 1,000 different facts, expressions. There are bound to be mistakes. The courts have held that, you know, simple mistakes, you can't sue us for that. There has to be an under a foundation of malice. There has to be real harm done, and those
actual malice.
Actual malice, but the other thing that's happening as public officials denigrate the press is our readers start to lose trust in us, and when they start to lose trust in us, they stop listening to us, and they go to other sources for their news, and often those other sources have bad information, have wrong information.
Yeah, and as you referenced, we make these minor mistakes, but there are more minor mistakes because we've lost so many of the proofreaders, especially in newspapers where there are extra copy editors and editors who could catch those things.
You know, there used to be a rule in my shop, you call a newsroom a shop sometimes, that every story got at least 3 or 4 reads, we call it, or 3 or 4 sets of eyes on it before it went off to press. And, you know, now they're lucky if they get, you know, 2 sets of eyes. Nothing goes into the paper with just 1 set of eyes, but or in most papers, but you're losing all the credibility. To put out a perfect paper is, I would say, high near impossible. Even the New York Times, reading their corrections is one of my fun parts of my day.
Yeah, and it's going to get tougher for journalists, isn't it? I mean, look at the artificial intelligence that's happening now. I just sent around a video to you folks, many have probably seen it, of celebrities at their current age hugging themselves. It looks real. It looks like there's 2 versions of themselves, and it's only going to get worse from there. Can you imagine what we're going to have to deal with in trying to verify information in the future?
And even the last 10 years has been tough. When you receive a video in the newsroom from somebody, you have to make sure that you have to talk to the person who shot the video and make sure you have the copyright to use the video. You know, the verification process for videos has been tough. For audio, I'm sure you have the same issue.
Sure.
For AI, we're encouraging the local newspapers to come up with their own AI set policies to how they're going to verify what's real and what's not. And then often, like, sometimes an AI image or a video may be worthy of being recirculated in your newspaper or on your website. You know, what protocols do you use when you do that? AI could be of use for us. For example, it could help you. It could offer suggested headlines, do some of the mundane work that people struggle with, maybe to generate a potential caption. What we run into problems with is that we rely on it too much to generate original content, and if it's not overseen by a real person, an editor who says, these words aren't right, this baseball game is not being reported incorrectly. Still, to this day, I can think I'm pretty good at detecting AI-generated content versus a person-generated content. AI-generated content has there's a tone to it that is fairly easy to detect. I'm probably wrong. I'm probably overconfident in that realm, but it still doesn't serve well for to produce content that people are actually going to want to read, and that's what we want. We don't want to turn people off by pumping out a lot of AI-generated content that is full of adjectives and adverbs often, and it's just fluff, or it's not interesting content to read. Still is the content that's generated by real people.
Oh my goodness, we have so much more that we can talk about. Should students be educated in the lower grades about media and media criticism? You know, what are we going to do?
Yes.
Well, that's it. That's all the time we have. And we can, of course, have you back to talk more about these important issues. She is Judy Patrick, Vice President of the New York Press Association. Of course, she's also the former editor of the Daily Gazette of Schenectady for so many years. We appreciate all your contributions, Judy, and I can't thank you enough for joining us on the Capital Connection this week.
Hey, woohoo, this was fun.
Yeah.
The Capital Connection is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. You can listen to The Capital Connection anytime at wamcpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcast. And join us again next week at this same time for another political conversation. For The Capital Connection, I'm David Giustina.
Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative.